ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Anthony Burke here, host of By Design on ABC Radio National, a show about the clever ideas and human stories behind the spaces, systems, and objects shaping everyday life. Whether you're curious about architecture, interior design, fashion, or anything in between, we reveal why design matters in a rapidly changing world. By Design on ABC Listen.
As Angus Taylor steps into the role of Liberal Party leader after his successful challenge against Susan Lee on Friday, the coalition now has to find a new footing. And it remains to be seen what shared policy positions will stick, or is its main common mission to win an election. What about liberalism as a political philosophy, as a shared set of values? As the Liberal Party reconsiders its future, today on Big Ideas, we look back at its past. Hello, Natasha Mitchell joining you on ABC Radio National and ABC Listen. Liberalism is usually associated with a belief in individual rights and liberties, in free markets, in limited government. But has liberalism evolved from those core tenets? And in the minds of its members and voters, what does the modern Liberal Party embody today? Big Ideas today comes to you from Trinity College at the University of Melbourne with a recent symposium on the legacy of former Liberal Party leader and Prime Minister of Australia, Malcolm Fraser, who came to power at another hectic moment for the Liberal Party, off the back of the dismissal of the then Labor Prime Minister, Gough Whitlam, by the Governor-General, John Kerr. So the event kicks off with former senior advisor to Fraser and former Federal Minister for Education in the Howard LNP government, David Kemp. His book, The Land of Dreams, traces the development of liberal thinking in Australia, and here he considers the value of Fraser's policies today.
How have Malcolm Fraser's initiatives stood up? In general, I would say the seminar has come to a conclusion that Malcolm Fraser's initiatives across a range of policies have stood up extraordinarily well, particularly in the area of social policies, whether it be his anti-racism and its effect on Aboriginal policy or immigration, or whether it's been his policies on human rights and individual liberties. In relation to the economy, I want to say something that points us to a problem and an issue with liberalism today, because Malcolm Fraser was remarkably positive about the importance of economic policy. And so he saw the state of the economy as being absolutely fundamental to realising his liberal philosophy. And yet we saw the outcome of that, and it's worth reflecting a bit on what happened then and what our current situation is as a result of his reactions to the economic problems arising from the Whitlam government, and indeed from the economic problems and initiatives under the Hawke-Fraser government that led, a bit like Malcolm's own government, to a recession at the very end, and that was where Hawke resigned. So there was a remarkable similarity between the long-term histories of those two governments. Malcolm saw his liberalism as fundamentally concerned with the individual. The individual for him, the freedom of the individual and the equal dignity of individual people was really, I think, his guiding principle. It was the individual, the treatment of the individual, the treatment of all individuals equally in terms of their human dignity that fundamentally lay at the root of Menzies' philosophy. And Menzies saw that dignity as coming from the freedom of the individual, choice and control over one's own life. And the moral character of the society was built on the obligations to individual people and, as he said, to the Australian people. But I want to say something about Malcolm Fraser and government and Malcolm Fraser and democracy. Malcolm saw democracy and Australia's democratic character as being a fundamental part of the liberal order, because democracy treated every individual equally in terms of their rights to vote and their citizenship rights to freedom of expression, of religion, of association, of conscience, of thought. And so Malcolm was very focused on the role of the individual, but the role of government he saw as being necessarily strong. And that's quite interesting, because we often associate Malcolm with smaller government. The Razor Gang experience is often referred to as being a not terribly successful effort to reduce the size of government after Whitlam had expanded it. But let me put another perspective on Malcolm and government. When he used that term strong government, he talked about government looking after, protecting and guiding the liberal order. And he saw the culture of the country, he saw its defence, its security arrangements, as being a fundamental part of the role of government. And that gave him an attitude towards the movement in economic policy towards deregulation. He wasn't against deregulation, and the Razor Gang did deregulate to some extent and did privatise. But it was generally felt not to be a major set of actions that came together in the Razor Gang. And I've often wondered whether Malcolm was influenced by the fact that the economic theory that was then dominant, that of Milton Friedman and Friedrich Hayek, was leading Australia towards a challenge to the role of government, projecting a globalism which was actually going to affect Australian culture and Australian society adversely. And he was, surprised me when I first heard this from him as one of his staff members, when he said that he didn't think economics was really a key part of liberalism. I'm not sure I agree with him totally on that, because of course Adam Smith's theory of liberty and economic freedom was fundamental to the foundation of the discipline of economics. But what Malcolm was worried about was actually, although the term sovereignty was not his favourite term, he was worried about the influence of the international order, of strong international corporations, and of Australian businesses not acting ethically on the culture and the individual person. And I remember his discussion of this in his economic policy, when he said that he was not going to take some very stronger action in relation to the reduction of the size of government, because he was very concerned that this would cause mass unemployment in the country, and it was more important to avoid unemployment than it was to cut government back further. In other words, he took a trade-off, he balanced those two together, and he favoured the option which left families intact and enjoying their jobs and the stability. In his view, the Liberal Party's liberalism had always rejected, throughout its existence since 1944, when Menzies led its formation, and indeed back to Deakin, laissez-faire. And indeed, he could have said back to George Reid, for those who know liberal history, that by federation, the liberal cause in Australia had not been laissez-faire. But George Reid and Deakin believed in a regulatory state that protected individuals and protected the worker in the workplace. So Fraser had to deal with an economy that was quite highly regulated. And he saw the problem with the lack of law applying to industrial relations and controlling unions after a case called the O'Shea case, which seemed to say, let's have a free-for-all in wages bargaining. He saw that problem as one that had to be dealt with by law. He didn't see productivity as a problem that were to be dealt with by a competitive economy. He wanted a competitive economy, but the focus at the time, as we've heard, was on technology. So Malcolm was left with an economy which was highly regulated and with a very powerful union movement. And it had developed a whole series of arrangements under which bargaining to keep wages down was the technique that was used, and not subjecting enterprises to international competition. And we had the extraordinary sight of the Prime Minister negotiating with the ACTU under Fraser to keep wages down. And it was the wage explosion, really, at the beginning of the 1980s in the metal trades industry that has a significant responsibility for those bad figures about unemployment and inflation. And so context is everything. And the context there was that Fraser was attempting to deal with an economy that was far from being a free economy in terms of the freedom of enterprise. The reference to private enterprise didn't necessarily mean freedom of enterprise. Now, I want to say something about Fraser's approach to liberalism. And one could ask, where did he get the liberal ideas from? Well, he got them from his family. He got them from his PPE course at Oxford University. And he came back from Oxford with a view, a very strong view, that philosophers could say what they thought about the right values and how you protected the individual. But it was the politician who would give those values substance in society. And he seemed to have an almost religious commitment, but a really strong motivation to pursue the liberal values through to their outcomes. And he told the Australian Liberal Students Federation in May 1981, and I quote him here, "The liberal believes that there is nothing inevitable about the course of history. It is human beings who make history. And in this process, history does not take sides. Make no assumptions that the future lies outside human control." In other words, Malcolm saw himself as strong enough to master the world that he came into as Prime Minister. And on the economic front, he found, and Australia was to find also under Hawke and Keating, that the power that had been accumulated by the trade union movement through the wages system, the arbitration system, and indeed through the accords of the Hawke-Keating government, was not a country and an economy that was operating to protect itself from international disruption that was competitive and that could innovate and take up technology in the way that he believed that it could. Now, that was very much a Menzian thought. And I want to say something about Menzies' view about politics and why the Liberal Party needed a philosophy. Menzies' view was that democracy was ultimately driven by private interest. It was driven by what Menzies occasionally called selfishness, that democracy encouraged people to go to government and seek benefits for themselves, whether they be subsidies or grants or a regulation on their competitors or a restriction of the market from overseas. Menzies saw that as being typical of democracy. His second point was there's no way to achieve the public interest in that way. There's no way to protect the interests of all Australians out of that democratic effort to get benefits from government. And the only way a political party could run democracy successfully over the longer term was to have a philosophy which would spell out what the public interest was and what the values of that public interest were to be. And that will raise an interesting question for us today, which we're looking forward to hearing our panel on, which is, does the Liberal Party still have a philosophy? The Liberal Party has taken a lot of stick today and yesterday. And a lot of that stick is due to the fact that people do not perceive the party as having a philosophy, and certainly not the philosophy of Fraser. There are others, there are more libertarian philosophies amongst some, but The question is the condition that Menzies laid down, to me that's a really important question, is the condition that Menzies and Fraser laid down that the Liberal Party should have a certain philosophy based on individual freedom and dignity, a sound approach to politics today. Now, the other thing I want to comment on before sitting down is, and being the chairman, rather than the former staffer of Malcolm Fraser, is the question of where was Fraser's influence? And I think it's been mentioned, and it was mentioned first again by Alex Downer, that Fraser believed deeply in the equal dignity of every person. That idea, I believe, from Fraser, became almost the driving idea of Australian politics. And certainly in the 21st century, both Labor and Liberal governments have committed themselves to policies which they say will better achieve the dignity of all Australians. And we've seen programs to help the disabled. We've seen programs in relation to Indigenous Australia. We've seen programs that relate to foreign affairs. We've heard how Menzies' values motivated the foreign policy of that government. Now, that's enough from me. I joined Fraser's staff in 1975. I had written an article called A Leader and a Philosophy. Fraser liked it. I think Tony Eggleton liked it. Tony Staley liked it. And Malcolm asked me to meet with him and have an argument with him, which he liked, of course, and offered me a position on his staff, which I took and became something of a speechwriter for him. Malcolm Fraser believed in institutions and institutions that worked. And he tried to make the Liberal Party work for him. He tried to make the states work. He tried to make the public service work. But he, in the end, found that that was very, very difficult and that wasn't always possible to make it work. And so we'll find in our discussion today, I think, that institutions are absolutely critical.
Former Federal Liberal Education Minister David Kemp, true liberal, question mark, is the headline of this symposium at the University of Melbourne, exploring the legacy of the Fraser government, which served from 1975 to 1983 in Australia. The university is home to the Malcolm Fraser Collection, one of Australia's largest personal collections of any Prime Minister. Well, now to a panel spanning generations and experience. Alexandra, or Alex Lefebvre, is Professor of Politics and Philosophy at the University of Sydney and author of the book Liberalism as a Way of Life. James Patterson is Liberal Senator for Victoria and Shadow Minister for Finance, Government Services and the Public Service. And starting with Liberal Senator for Victoria and former Assistant Minister for Social Services, Housing and Disability Services, Sarah Henderson, at this event held around the anniversary of the 1975 federal election.
Well, of course, it was on this day 50 years ago, after 3 years of economic mismanagement and failure under Whitlam, including, of course, the infamous Kemlani loan scandal, that Australians voted to turn on the lights and elect a Liberal government. Malcolm Fraser became Australia's 20th Prime Minister. It was a landslide victory. The loan scandal represented a fundamental breakdown of parliamentary democracy. And Malcolm Fraser was a man of considerable principle. As Tony Abbott noted in his most powerful book, Australia, A History, Paul Hasluck said Fraser divided people into those who acted according to principle and those who did not. Fraser's principles were founded in liberalism, focused on individual rights, freedoms and dignity, most evident through his support for multiculturalism, refugees, human rights, Indigenous land rights, and the establishment of the SBS. Fraser also took education, both in schools and universities, extremely seriously, as well as support for the family. He curtailed spending, fought high inflation and unemployment, albeit, of course, with significant challenges. Temporarily indexed personal tax rates and was a champion against apartheid. In a landscape dominated by unions, tariff protection, and challenging economic conditions, there was no fervour for, or no real fervour for economic reform, such as on free trade, deregulation, or strong competition laws. And as we know, that caused some internal disharmony and controversy. But after the chaos of the Whitlam years, Malcolm Fraser was determined to steady the ship and provide the Australian people with much needed confidence in his government's democratic legitimacy. I first met Malcolm Fraser as a young girl, I'm giving away things now, when he was campaigning in Geelong as the opposition leader prior to the 1975 election. My sister had a broken arm and he signed her plaster cast. There was great excitement about meeting a future PM, as my mother very clearly told me. In our family and in so many Australian families, Malcolm Fraser was a rock star. My last encounter with Malcolm was after my election as the member for Corangamite, which of course adjoins his old seat of Wannon. He proudly told me how hard he had worked for his constituents and counselled me to do the same, meticulously follow up on every issue, fix problems, hold those ministers to account, and make sure the voices of the people you represent are heard. I'm very proud to be here today to honour Malcolm's legacy, but we are here to talk about liberalism in today's context, and these, of course, are very different times. And I think one of the great challenges that we have as Liberals, as members of the Liberal Party, is to restore the faith of the Australian people in our liberal democracy. And I think the challenge is far greater in some respects than it was 50 years ago. Most Australians support the essence of liberalism, the belief that individuals possess inherent rights and dignity, and that legitimate government exists to protect those rights through the rule of law, representative institutions, and limits on power. But it is not surprising that Australians do not have the same respect for elected representatives, for our institutions, and for the role of government to protect our rights and freedoms and advance our lives. Consider what we face today: skyrocketing cost of living, energy policy in disarray, immigration out of control, housing out of reach of so many young Australians, and an education system in decline, with one in three children failing to reach basic proficiency levels in reading, writing, and maths. The scars of the pandemic still run very deep here in Victoria, not just in the acute mental harms to Victorians locked down for the best part of 2 years, and particularly to so many young children, but the loss of fundamental freedoms, which resulted, for instance, in protesters being pelted with rubber bullets and people being detained for putting their bins out on a quiet night outside their house on the nature strip. A key role of government to support those who most need our help is being dismantled by the Albanese government, I would contend very strongly, and because the government is failing to rein in excessive spending and exercise economic restraint, which was such a hallmark of Malcolm Fraser's leadership. The government is moving to universal childcare, regardless of how much a family earns. It seems under this government, every single family is entitled to receive support. And the 5% home deposit scheme, which under our government was a very narrow scheme geared to those who most needed help, is now open to all Australians, including the children of the most wealthy Australians, which is also a scheme driving up house prices. Every elected representative, I believe, needs to be guided by a strong moral compass, and that starts with speaking the truth. Energy security is key to economic security and prosperity, and I think the Federal Parliamentary Liberal Party's decision to abolish net zero, to speak the truth about the importance of our resources sector, including coal, and the need to embrace nuclear have been very, very major steps forward for our party. But we also must harness the courage and the conviction to make the right calls on other key challenges. It's a very big job, but that job starts with rebuilding the faith of the Australian people that we are all up to the task. Thank you.
First, I'm a philosopher, not a politician, and I'm certainly not a scholar of Australian politics. Second, I'm Canadian. I'm going to come back to that. And the brief that I had in talking here was to kind of bring us up to the state of play, as I see it, of what liberalism is today and bigger trends of where it might be heading. And I wanted to comment on two things that I found have changed pretty significant since Fraser's time and Fraser's thinking. The first I'll talk about for about 5 minutes is about how we live our liberalism today, and in particular, how widespread I believe liberalism has become in our everyday, ordinary life. And second, I want to talk a little bit about the world beyond and where conservatism today is heading, which I believe is in a post-liberal direction, which puts you two in a pickle. Let me start, though, with an anecdote, which kind of brings me to how I kind of started to think about liberalism. So, it's coming back into play. I'm Canadian. I moved here with my wife in 2010, and we moved here from Canada. And for the first several years we lived in Australia, we would always return home to Canada for Christmas. And it was a nice thing, and snowy Christmas is lovely. But frankly, it was getting super expensive, and year after year it was adding up. And in 2016, we're like, okay, enough, we're staying put. So 2016, we had a welcome novelty, Christmas in summer, which for us Canadian just blows our minds. So we had a long breakfast, opened the gifts, and then we headed down to our local beach. So I live in Coogee. You guys know what that is? Yeah, kind of Bondi, just a little bit south. And I got there like 2 p.m. Well, it turns out all of Australia was there, and about half of Ireland was there as well. And it was tattoos and bikinis and beer as far as the eye could see. And my first thought seeing this scene was, this is the most godless place I've ever lived in. Then I took a beat, I'm like, okay. And then I started to reflect, like, okay, these people, okay, it's a wild party, it's messy, fine. But these people here have integrated moral lives, they have a moral compass, things are okay, they're not basket cases. So if this is how they hang out on their most solemn of days, and in a country that's becoming increasingly secular, 40% in Australia, 40% in the US, 60% in the UK, godless New Zealand at 80% now, I think, then where is it that we draw our values from? And that's the big question I wanted to pose ourselves. So I ask this to my students in my class once a year, and we can play along if you like. If not, it's up to you. It's going to be a different answer for this room. But raise your hand if you are not a religious person, if you don't profess a faith, if you're not theist. Okay, so I'm looking at the crowd, that's like 50-ish, let's say. In my class, so I teach young people at the University of Sydney, which I know is its own little ecosystem, but that number is never below 80, typically above 90% of people putting up their hands. And what I want to suggest, what I propose in the book, Liberalism as a Way of Life, is that liberalism is now effectively that thing that people who put up their hands should point to as basically the core of their moral value. So if you affirm things like freedom, fairness, tolerance, irony, if that's how you roll, if that's your vibe, then I think liberalism has sunk its teeth very deeply into you. And I don't want to say that people who didn't put up their hand or were Christian or what people of faith, of course you can be deeply liberal, and I don't mean to contest that, as authentically as I can be. But I do think for some people, we are, as I put it in my book, liberal all the way down. And that's what I tried to think about it, and I really wanted to think about liberalism as what political thinkers would call a hegemony, something that wraps its tentacles around us at every turn. When we turn on Netflix and listen to watch the most algorithmically generated show about finding our way, when we go on a dating app, when we have respectful codes of conduct in our professions. That's just liberalism, liberalism, liberalism hitting us up. And I just want to give you one example that always clicks about how deeply our liberalism may run, which is something that every Australian is natively like an Olympic level athlete at, and that is swearing. The history of swear words is one of the most fascinating topics I know, because by looking at what a culture thinks is a swear word, you can very, very quickly reverse engineer what they hold their core moral commitments could be. And in the history of the West, there's two kinds of swear words. You have your sacramental words, your gods, your dammits, etc., and then you have your profanities, your bodily obscenity kind of terms. Now, Australians have no problem using any of these terms right from breakfast in any given day. And we tend to think that we are kind of post-swear word, we're all so cool, we can say anything. But of course today, there's a different kind of swear word that we can absolutely not say, and most of us wouldn't dream of saying it, which are slurs. We would never dream of using slurs in public, we'd get canceled in 5 minutes. But privately, that's not where you go. And slurs are words that are designed to undermine the self-respect of other people, to punch down, diminish their sense of their humanity. And why is that so bad? Because we're liberal. Because the one sacrosanct commitment that we all have, I believe, is to ensure respect for persons and a person's own sense of their own dignity and worth. So the kind of pitch I'm trying to make is that even in the words that we choose subconsciously, how we just navigate the world, we are liberal perhaps in a very deep way. So that's where I think as our liberalism has changed, with a retreat of religion, a secularization. Liberalism has taken nature abhors a vacuum, so does ideology. It has rushed in to fill a place. So that's the first thing I wanted to mention. The second thing I want to mention, and I'll be brief here, where I think the conservative world is heading, not just conservative, but the non-liberal world, let's put it that way. When I look at the world today, I see one big trend happening over and over in countries that we would never associate with one another. And that's the return of the concept of the good life and of moral flourishing into politics. And that so many governments are deeply concerned, not with the liberal promise of neutrality of you do you, all do me, but rather trying to inculcate, to instruct their citizens in a good faith way into certain human excellences that they deem the best for their people. I'm talking China, I'm talking Hungary, I'm talking Russia, Iran, Israel, MAGA, you name it. And what I want to say is that all of these have become big government, moralized, some countries have never been liberal, like China, let's be clear, but all of them are trying to recover this idea of leading us to meaning, to personal fulfillment, and to flourishing. And Australia, I don't think, has gone that way. I don't think it can go that way. But I think that, and I'm grateful for that, but I think it is a big worldwide challenge that has changed since the time of Fraser. And his strongly, I mean, David gave me some of Fraser's writings, and it was just like, it was comfort food. It was terrific. I'm nom, nom, nom as a liberal. And the anti-perfectionism and the modesty of it and the restraint and the humanity, the kind of big-hearted, post-racial menschness of it was striking. I don't know if that train has sailed, but it is something to consider. Thank you.
I think George Brandis is right, as he wrote, that as a party, we are terrible at simply understanding and sharing our history, let alone celebrating it. And I am delighted to be here today to participate in this conversation, because I think it is important to embrace and understand all parts of our legacy. We obviously know that Malcolm Fraser became estranged from the Liberal Party in his post-parliamentary life, but that doesn't mean there aren't things from his time in public life that are worthy of celebration by Liberals today, nor that there aren't any lessons to learn from his time in public life, and particularly his time in government. David set this panel some homework in preparing for today. He sent us a couple of Malcolm Fraser's writings. One was a speech he delivered in 1975, a Menzies lecture in Perth while he was still the opposition leader, although not for very long afterwards. And a second, which was an excerpt from his book, The Common Ground, which included his 1980 speech to the South Australian division of the Liberal Party at the State Council meeting. I was very struck reading these speeches, and particularly how they are so unlike anything that a modern leader of the Liberal Party would deliver today. They were incredibly analytical, almost as if, David, a political scientist had written them for Malcolm Fraser. And what struck me about it was a leader who was engaging with ideas, engaging with philosophy, openly grappling with the contradictions within our Liberal philosophy, in particular the speech to the South Australian Division in 1980. He observes the changing character of conservatism globally and attempts to publicly reconcile liberalism and conservatism in a speech to party members. He rightly notes that in Australia, to be a conservative is in many ways to be a liberal because we have an inherently liberal settlement, and if you're seeking to preserve that settlement, then you are in many ways a liberal. But he doesn't gloss over the differences that arise in conservatism and liberalism. We now know that he did read David's 1972 seminal article of political science on a leader and a philosophy, and he's clearly taking up David's challenge that part of the role of political leadership is to speak about and articulate a vision grounded in a philosophy for your party. It's critically important that you do so because it serves as a framework for your colleagues and the public to understand what it is your party believes in, but also, as David said in reference to Menzies, it is an anchor by which you can govern well in the national interest and in the public interest and not get diverted by sectional interests or vested interests. I would say one of the many failings of the Liberal Party in recent years is that we have completely failed to do this in a pretty profound and consequential way. It has been a very long time since a leader of the Liberal Party engaged in anywhere near that sort of intellectual leadership as Malcolm Fraser did in those speeches. It's not just the responsibility of the leader of the parliamentary party to do that. As parliamentarians, as representatives of the party in the community, we each have an obligation to do that. And I made my own contribution to this discussion a few months ago in the Tom Hughes oration, where I made my contribution to what I think is the best path forward for the Liberal Party. It's very clear that the centre-right in Australia, and at least in the Anglosphere, in the English-speaking world, is in a state of flux. And since I delivered my speech, unfortunately, we've had data points to suggest it's even more true than I feared it was at the time. And that is particularly evident in the increased support expressed for One Nation in public opinion polls. This is a very serious dilemma and challenge for the Liberal Party. One Nation has gone from a 6% vote at the federal election to 18%, as high as 18% in some polls since the election, a 300% increase in their vote. And many of those are people who are currently disaffected, former supporters of the Liberal Party, possibly just parking their vote in One Nation as a protest, as their dissatisfaction with the Liberal Party. But we should not be so complacent to assume that it couldn't become a permanent and ongoing phenomenon on the centre-right in Australia. And if that were to take place, that would be to our immense detriment as a political movement, but I also think as a country. One of the main critiques of One Nation is that they are a party of protest, not a party of government. And that is certainly true, and I think borne out by their total lack of interest in policy or proposing solutions to actually solve the problems that face Australia today. They are expert at weaponising grievance for political gain, but very poor at proposing solutions to address those grievances. But this critique of One Nation is actually quite a limited and utilitarian critique. It's not enough just to say that they're a party of protest and not government. A much more important critique, in my view, is that One Nation and other parties like it are parties of personality, not parties of philosophy. That is what should distinguish them from a party like the Liberal Party, which exists for the purpose of defending and implementing liberal philosophy and values in government when we have the honour of holding it. Parties like One Nation do have recognisable instincts, they have prejudices, but they have no overarching worldview or vision for the future of Australia. And they are intrinsically linked to the whims of the leader of the party at the time. Once leaders of parties like this leave the political stage, it's often very difficult to translate them to the next generation, who, because they have no shared philosophy that can pass on between generations of politicians, as you can in a major party like the Liberal Party, which is centred around a philosophy or set of values. Now, I know they would hate to hear me say this, they would take great exception to this comparison, but there are many similarities between the kind of politics practiced by One Nation and the kind of politics practiced by the Teals. They obviously have different worldviews, but they actually have a very similar approach to their political positioning, which is they define themselves primarily by what they are not. They distinguish themselves by how they are different to the Liberal Party, and they also don't articulate a coherent governing philosophy for Australia. Now, often in the Liberal Party, we are told that we either should become a party more like the Teals or a party more like One Nation. And my view is they are false choices for the Liberal Party, which would lead us to ruin if we went in either direction. What I think we instead need to do is revive and clearly articulate our own consistent set of Liberal values in a way that we have failed to do as a party in recent years. I think we need to be faithful to our traditions, including from the Fraser era, but update them for the modern problems that face Australia. It would be extremely unwise, in my view, for us to abandon free markets and embrace economic populism, as some advocate, and it would also be equally unwise for us to vacate the field on cultural issues around identity and sovereignty, as others suggest we should. This need not be an existential moment in the history of the Liberal Party, but depending on how we respond, particularly at the federal level and particularly over the next few years, it may well be. Thank you.
Liberal Senator for Victoria and the Shadow Minister for Finance, Government Services and the Public Service, James Patterson. You also heard there from political philosopher Professor Alex Lefebvre, author of Liberalism as a Way of Life, and Victorian Liberal Senator Sarah Henderson. Natasha Mitchell here, bringing you this timely discussion on Australian Liberal Party history as the party contemplates the shape of its future. On ABC Radio National's live event show, Big Ideas, we're coming to you from the University of Melbourne. Political historian and former Federal Minister David Kemp is now exploring the philosophical foundations of liberalism and its cultural significance in Australia with the panel.
James, could I ask you to follow on directly from that? How could the Liberal Party has come to this position? Malcolm Fraser understood that institutions that had a responsibility to implement liberal values sometimes needed reform. And he spent a lot of time trying to reform the public service to give him the advice that he needed. And he introduced also, of course, the ministerial officer system on a formal basis, although Whitlam had begun that. But the Liberal Party, you know, started off with, as a party with a philosophy, as Menzies described. Fraser clearly brought in a philosophy, which he attempted to implement with incredible energy. I mean, he's one of the most remarkable people who have actually held that senior office because of his extraordinary breadth of his views and energy. But then what happened?
I think there are two reasons. Firstly, there are differences within the broad family of Australian liberalism and on the broad centre-right. And sometimes when you're a political leader and you have many problems, attempting to reconcile those differences doesn't seem like the most fruitful way to spend your time, and it certainly requires very deep intellectual heavy lifting to engage in that exercise. But I think the second reason is I think our politics has become much more technocratic, and we're told that we are alienating people if we talk about politics in these terms, that it doesn't meet people where they are, that they're busy in their lives, and that if we spend time doing this, we'll demonstrate we're detached from the common experience of Australian people. And I certainly wouldn't advocate that a political leader of any stripe should deliver high-minded philosophical speeches every day of the week. We do have to be practical. We do have to meet people where they are. But we have seen the consequence in recent years of not doing any of that philosophical and value-based framework for what we do. We only talk about the widgets and the gadgets that we offer at election, the handouts, that with no philosophy then that it surrounds it to give it any architecture, then we shouldn't be surprised that we're just seen as one brand of many brands and not one that you should have any particular loyalty to in the political marketplace.
Alex, could I ask you a question? I was struck by a remark that Nick Dorenforth of the Curtin Institute, which is a Labor think tank, used the other day when he said, we are now entering a period of post-liberalism. Now, I'm trying to reconcile that with the octopus-like clutch that liberal values have on our culture at the moment. And I know you've looked a bit at this issue, so what would he mean by post-liberalism and what attitude should liberals take to what he's referring to?
So to step back for a moment, I don't know if this has been said in this conference yet, but I think it's an important historical point to make, which is that liberalism is a pretty modern ideology. So historians like to play this fun game of trying to locate the most distant antecedent for liberalism. It's like the Bible, the Stoic. Okay. People started calling themselves liberal only in the 19th century. That's when people started applying that term to themselves. And interestingly, they started that liberalism as a political movement began as a reaction against democracy. Think of all the major liberal institutions that we have. All of them are counter-majoritarian. Division of powers, judicial review, individual rights, because people were freaked out by the French Revolution in the early 19th century and tried to establish institutions and pedagogies to try to block populism. And today we speak of liberal democracy as if it's like this peaches and cream, it's always gone together kind of package. And no, that is a very hard-earned marriage of 200 years of negotiation. And so what I think is happening all around the world today is perhaps the slow and painful divorce of those two terms, such that democracy would start to become, to assert itself outside of liberal boundaries. And if democracy means sovereignty of the people and majority rule, it can very consistently be democratic and non-liberal at the same time. So Orban calls Hungary an illiberal democracy, and he means it. He means this country is for a certain kind of person. And that's what I wanted to say. So in some places, the tentacles run deep, but there is a counter movement to try to reassert democracy, I think, as against liberalism and break that equation apart that we've just relied on for 150 years.
Sarah, if ever there's an area of Australian political life and an important part of our cultural institutions, it's the education systems and their capture by bureaucracies and industrial relations, union control. I say that from personal experience because as a Minister for Education in the Howard government, I found the only way one could possibly reform education was to in fact appeal to the parents and try to stir up a movement for reform on behalf of their children. But you've obviously thought a lot about these things and things like national curriculum, which seek to impose a one-size-fits-all, if you like, on every school in Australia. It doesn't, in fact, because, of course, as we know, the states don't always adopt it. But what sort of values do you bring to bear on the question of how the education system should be organised?
Well, David, I mentioned before, I think one of the big challenges that we have in our party is that we've got, and as elected representatives, is when we get things wrong, we've got to speak to the truth. And I think on both sides of politics in the past, we've made mistakes in education. And one of the mistakes that we made, and we went down the pathway of the national curriculum, but embedded in the national curriculum, for instance, are these cross-curriculum priorities. And they require that teachers teach every subject through the prism of Indigenous culture and history, sustainability, and a connection with Asia. Now, all of those endeavours and learnings are very important in the school system, but the fact that teachers are required to teach grade one maths or year seven English through that prism is not evidence-based teaching. It no longer, or never did, frankly, reflect the sorts of curricula that we are seeing being utilised by high-performing countries. So one of the big challenges that we have, I think, at the moment is that we do need to speak the truth when we get policies wrong, and I think that's one that we got badly wrong. And I support the notion of a national curriculum such, whether that's the right name I'm not sure, but a national curriculum should just simply set out the achievement standards in each year level, and which really fundamentally become a guide for the states and territories. And of course, teachers have been so let down by universities as well. The teacher training in our country has really let down our teachers, such that so many young Australians are just not learning. Teachers have not been taught how to teach explicitly, And so I think, you know, as a country, we have let down young Australians in so many respects. And so for us now coming to grips with where we go and our policies, I think it's incredibly important that we are able to take a very honest look at some of our policy positions in the past. And where something has not worked or where we have made an error, then we've got to be honest. I mean, the Job Ready Graduates program, which basically doubled the cost of certain degrees in the humanities, is an approach that has not worked. And that was an initiative of our government. And I see Andrew Norton there, when Andrew and I have spoken about this over a very long period of time. And these are really difficult conversations to have. And we did commit early this year to review the Job Ready Graduates program. Because why should someone, a young Australian who wants to study in the arts or law, why should they be paying such exorbitant fees to study an undergraduate degree within the humanities? So I think it's just so wrong. As I say, it is a policy that hasn't worked. But I also think that's very important, and James and I are in a bit of a different position. I'm on the backbench, so I have a little bit more freedom. But when bills become before the parliament, everything that we do and say tells Australians what we stand for. And I think we've had some real challenges in expressing what we stand for as a party, and not just under Susan Lee, but in the last few years. And I have probably a little bit of a different view about One Nation. I think one of the reasons that One Nation is flourishing in the polls is because there has been a bit of a policy vacuum. They have stepped up, and whether you agree or disagree is immaterial. But they have made their positions very strongly known to the Australian people, including on energy policy. Arguably, we took much longer to get to grips on matters like that. I mean, I remember, you know, whether it's Malcolm Fraser, whether it's John Howard, Australians don't always expect that they will agree with every sentiment expressed by their political leaders. But they want to understand what our leaders stand for. And Fraser was brilliant at setting out his agenda, at setting out his passion for individual rights. And of course, there was so much support across the country for his refugee program as a result. I mean, we brought in more than 10,000 Syrian refugees under Tony Abbott. But did we promote that as we should at the time? Arguably, we didn't. I mean, I had a situation, and I'll finish here on this point. There have been a couple of education bills that have come before the parliament, and I ended up crossing the floor to move a number of amendments, including an amendment to cap international students, which was a strong integrity measure, but also an amendment to tie the student visa to the institution, which the universities were crying out for, and the government did not act on, and yet we didn't as a party act on that either. And so I ended up crossing the floor, joined by a member of One Nation, to move those amendments, because for me as a backbencher, I wanted to send the message, these matters are very important, and there's no point coming back in 12 or 18 months' time and telling the Australian people this is what we stand for when we didn't do anything at the time the bill was before the parliament. So we've got lots of challenges ahead, but I think one of the biggest challenges that we have is not just to define our philosophy, not just to return to those great Menzian principles, but to be articulating that every single day. And that remains a big challenge.
Would you please join with me in congratulating our panel?
Former Federal Liberal Minister David Kemp, in conversation with current Victorian Liberal Senators Sarah Henderson and James Patterson, and political philosopher Alex Lefebvre, a professor at the University of Sydney. What is liberalism today? If it's close to your heart and mind in these tumultuous times for the Liberal Party, we'd love to hear your answer to that question, and you can email us bigideas@abc.net.au. is how to get in touch. That's bigideas@abc.net.au. My name is Natasha Mitchell. Don't forget, you can find and follow Big Ideas on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts. And from the Liberal Party to the ALP, next on Big Ideas, political journalist, former staffer, Sean Kelly, is considering what Labor stands for. Join us then.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.